Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Tales from the Doghouse Separation Anxiety Explained. I am Stacey Bell in the U.S. with Focused Fun. And with me today is...
Hello, I'm Ness Jones. I am in Australia from Separation Anxiety in Dogs Decoded, and I am very excited because we have a special guest today. Her name is Dr. Holly Tett. Holly is a human psychologist, but she is also a dog trainer, and she is in London, England, and her business is called Pause Up Dogs. Holly, welcome so much. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes.
We're going to be talking about how difficult it is having a dog with separation anxiety, but maybe you could introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your journey with dogs and human psychology before we get started.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. So my business, I do lots of separation anxiety cases because, of course, I had my own wonderful dog who had pretty horrendous separation anxiety, to be honest. He was the kind of dog who I couldn't even cross the room without him getting very, very distressed. And back in the day, I didn't know what I know now. And I tried leaving him and hearing him howling, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. So when I made the transition from working solely as a human psychologist to doing dog behavior, and kind of meshing the two together, really, I was like, I need to work with people with dogs with separation anxiety because it can be such a lonely place for so many people. And I think the beauty of the online space now is that people can talk to others who are in the same boat, but having that professional as well that can help you is really, really important, I think. So yeah, that's a little bit about my journey. And now, as you were saying, Ness, I've got Pause Up Dogs, and I work with pet parents and also dog professionals as well.
What made you do the transition from human to dog stuff?
So I still do a little bit with people.
Right.
But for me, I should have worked with animals from the beginning.
Right.
I don't know why I didn't. When I was a child, I wanted to be a vet, and then that kind of fizzled out. I just have more of an affinity with animals, I think. But I think the beauty of what we do is that we get to work with the people as well.
Yeah.
So, it's the best of both worlds, really.
What were you going to say, Stacey? Sorry.
I was just going to say that Holly also has a podcast.
Yes.
And that's why I feel like I know you, even though we've only just met today, is because I've listened to your podcast some. So tell us a little bit about your journey with your own dog with separation anxiety.
Yeah, so his name is Riggs. He is now 9 years old, and he came to me as a rescue at 6 months old. He was an accidental dog where it was a case of, we just need someone to have him for 24 hours. And then lo and behold, obviously I could never let him go. But yes, it was really tough. So initially I was doing all of the wrong things, really. He was an anxious boy in lots of ways, and separation anxiety was definitely the hardest thing. When we finally got a good plan in place, it was hard going even then. So I remember very clearly New Year's Eve sitting out in my car with everyone else partying. And I was like, well, I need to use this time because this is like 5 hours where I can do loads of practice. So I think even when you feel like you know what you're doing and you've got a good plan in place, there's still those ups and downs, isn't there? It's never just a linear, we'll just do this, this, and this, and everything's all better. Whenever you're working with any kind of emotion, whether it's dogs or people, it just doesn't work like that. We have to account for those emotions and work with them rather than just sort of rigidly sticking to our plan, I think, sometimes.
Right.
I mean,
and I think that's... Go ahead, Ness.
Oh, no, I was just going to say for us, in terms of our clients or the people we work with, there's so much emotional trauma involved in that because they do feel like prisoners in their own homes. They feel trapped. They don't feel like they've got lives. They want to get their lives back. And it's a lot to struggle with. And often their partners or their friends and family, they don't understand, why they're why they can't leave their dog alone. They think it's a bit pathetic. That's mm-hmm. awful to say, but you know, that's how they feel. So it's a lot to deal with. Go, Stacey.
No, I was just going to say that roller coaster ride of separation anxiety training or helping your dog overcome any anxiety based behavior is so up and down. And, you know, even in the position we are in, seeing so many of the teams that we kind of help coach through the process, even seeing those, how normal those ups and downs are, you know, when one of my clients is in kind of a blip or even a full on regression, it's like, it hits me too. You know, it's hard for me not to kind of get sucked down by it, even though I know it's a normal part of the process, right? Because you just so much with every fiber of your being want them to be successful and want it to be easy for them. So I'm assuming you have some tips on how to kind of help us come to grips with those ups and downs a bit better.
Yeah, and the emotional trauma of having a dog with, just living with a dog with separation anxiety.
Definitely. I mean, one of the questions that I ask most people when I first get started is, who do you talk to most about this difficulty? So who do you have this conversation with? Mm-hmm. And I say, like, is it your partner? Is it your best friend? Is it your neighbor because they're barking through the walls? Is it your child? And people usually say, oh, my friend or my partner. Well, actually, the person that you're having this conversation with the most is yourself, because we keep ourselves company 24/7, apart from when we're asleep. We talk to ourselves all the time in our head, and a lot of us have a really critical voice. Mm-hmm. So when we do have those troughs, when we do have the little lapses or the full-on relapses, the first thing that lots of us do is blame ourselves. Oh, I pushed that too far. I left him for too long. Oh, I must have picked that up. That must have triggered him. Oh, maybe I'm not doing what the trainer said correctly. Blame, 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 blame. And that's really heavy, because when we feel that blame, we feel that guilt, because of course we want our dog to feel safe and happy and content. And maybe we also have some of our own difficult feelings, maybe a bit annoyed at our dogs, a bit angry, mm-hmm. frustrated because we feel like a prisoner in our own home. And then again, some more guilt, another dollop on top. And when we are constantly beating ourselves up like that, it doesn't help us. It's not going to help you feel any better, and it's certainly not going to help your dog either, because you're not going to be in that best frame of mind to be able to be like, right, okay, let's regroup, let's have a couple of days off and we'll start again on Monday or whatever. So the first thing I would say is, when you are feeling those really difficult, heavy emotions and all that guilt and everything like that, you need to have some kind of support where you can go and offload that. Now, you may be fortunate enough to have someone in your life that you can talk to about it. Sometimes not everyone has that. So whether that is an online group, whether that is listening to a podcast like this one, whether that is enlisting the help of a professional where you say, can I just send you a WhatsApp once a week to let you know how I'm getting on? There is a real lightness in being able to just split it all out and then say, right, okay, I'm ready to start again. So yeah, that's where I would start.
Yeah, that's really mm-hmm. interesting, and it's such a good point. When you said the only time you may not be having these thoughts is when you're asleep, but often as well, just as an aside, this is the stuff that keeps you up at night as well. So you're maybe not even getting the sleep that you need, which is going to also impact your mental state as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think people should do with when they've got partners that aren't really supportive? I've had a lot of clients where mum mm. is the one doing all the training and dad is like, or not necessarily dad, but, you know, whoever is like, oh, I don't want any part of this. I don't agree with this training. I don't think it's the right type of training or whatever. It's, you know, you sort it out. I don't want to know, and I think it's just a load of rubbish or whatever, you know, like they're not getting that emotional support that they need. What should they do?
Yeah, that's really, really hard. And I think we see that in lots of areas of dog training, not just separation anxiety, but this real kind of disagreement between partners, especially, but it can be dog walkers and people. It can be anyone that's involved in your mm-hmm. dog's life, really, can't it? I was speaking to a lady the other day who was saying she was dreading Thanksgiving and dreading Christmas because family come that have totally different views on dog training, and they're just like, what, this is a load of rubbish. So it is a big factor for sure. What I would say is, whenever you're in any kind of disagreement with someone, whatever it's about, if we try and convince the other person, often that can be the worst thing to do, because we end up pushing them further down the other extreme. Mm-hmm. When you find yourself in a position where you're over explaining something, you've tried 7 different ways of explaining it and the person still isn't getting it, just don't carry on, would be my opinion. What I would say is get that support network elsewhere, so you've got someone to talk to. Separately, you go ahead and do the work, do exactly what you know is the right way to work with it. And then you can just show your partner, whoever it is, the results. Showing someone that something works is a way better method than trying to convince them with words, in my experience. So yeah, I think that the other thing you can do, depending on the relationship you have with that person, is appealing to their kind of human side, really, and saying, look, I know we've got differing opinions on this. I'm prepared to do this work. You don't have to do any of it, but I need you to back me up. Mm-hmm. So when I'm having a hard day, I need you to understand that this is important to me. This is something that's really mm-hmm. meaningful to me. So whether you agree with it or not, I need that backup. And hopefully, if you have got a partner who's supportive in other ways, that should kind of tap into them a little bit more than just saying, this is the right way to do it.
Like, that approach is one that I think that really resonates with me, in trying to coach my clients through some of these difficult conversations too, because exactly what you're saying is trying to talk somebody who has like a strong differing opinion into your opinion is not usually that useful, but appealing to, you know, how much they love you and want to support you in all of those things, you know, by saying, you know, this is important to me. Can you support me in these ways? You know, like, I know you're not going to do the training, and I know, like, but if you could pick me up and give me a hug when I have a bad day, or, you know, and just kind of try to stop that conflict feeling about it, even if there's not 100% buy-in. I think that can be a really useful way to tackle that.
Yeah, definitely, because it's hard enough, isn't it?
It is
hard enough doing the training. It's not fun training. It's not exciting. It's boring a lot of the time and stressful other times. So you don't want that additional pressure from a partner as well on top of that. The best example to kind of liken it to is politics. You know, you have one opinion, yes. Someone has a differing opinion. You're just going to do this. You're never going to bring them over to your side. They're never going to bring you over to their side. So yeah, exactly. Something meeting in the middle is the way to go, for sure.
Politics mm-hmm. and religion. Yeah, for sure. So what would you say to somebody that maybe was doing the training, was going really well, but then, as Stacey said, they have that terrible blip, maybe a regression or what have you, and they feel like they've gone back to square one? As that's hard to deal with, I think. You know, you're kind of feeling positive and then suddenly hit that wall and it's not a nice feeling. How would you suggest people deal with that?
Yeah, it's not a nice feeling at all. I think there's two sides to it. I think there's a practical side of dealing with that, and that is giving yourself and your dog a break, if possible, giving yourself some time off, sharing with someone in said support circle and saying, oh my gosh, this is really hard week. I'm just going to take some time off. And then the emotional side of it is, for me as a psychologist, I want to think about what is the real trigger, what is the triggering the emotional response with me, because you as the human caregiver, it's perfectly natural and normal to feel upset, frustrated, disappointed, And to be fearful about what does this mean? Does this mean we're way back at square one and we have to start from 0 seconds again? Or if we give ourselves some time off, can we come back in at 10 minutes or wherever you're up to? All these kinds of questions. But what we also want to think about is what's triggering us under the surface a little bit. So, you know, in the subconscious mind, why are we so upset by this? And often it's because we have some negative feelings about ourselves that are usually quite well hidden. So these might be feelings from childhood. Maybe you never felt good enough at school, or maybe you never felt like you could achieve in comparison to your friends or your siblings or whoever else was in your life. So often when we have these really big emotional reactions, yes, we are reacting to the thing that's happening, the regression in our training, for example, but also it's tapping into some of these kind of deeper feelings that we have about ourselves that are usually quite negative. So if ever I'm in a place where I'm really upset or distressed by something with my dog or with anything, I try and ask the why question. So I say, why am I upset? And you'll come out with your first response, which will be, oh, we're doing so well. And now he's lost it completely and I'm so frustrated. And then you say, okay, and why? And you just keep asking yourself that question, and it allows you to go down the layers until you get to the bottom. And when you get right to the bottom, it's usually something a bit deeper, like I feel like a failure, or I don't feel good enough, or something like that. And when you get to that point, it's almost like a release. You can take a massive deep breath in, deep breath out, and then say, okay, well, that's not the case, because I've got loads of evidence of all this great stuff that I've done in my life. And that allows you to kind of reset yourself just a little bit.
That's a good answer. And I know, I'm not sure about you, Stacey, but I've had a lot of clients where the owners, obviously they're invested in the training and that's why they're doing the training, but when there might be like a number of warm-up steps and there's like a final step, the target duration. And when they get to that last step, they want it to be so good with all their heart. And they actually get anxious before they walk out the door. Have you got any tips for people to kind of calm the mind down a little bit so that, because we know that that could potentially impact the dog to do well when they walk out the door.
Yeah. And there's nothing worse than when people say, I know it's me. I'm getting myself into such a state and I'm causing a problem. So yes, definitely. There's a few things that you can do in the moment to kind of settle yourself and calm yourself down. So let's say you are sat on the sofa, your keys are already in your pocket, you've got your trainers on and you're ready to go in the next 10 minutes or something like that. You can play the 5-4-3-2-1 game. So this is something you can do in the house, and you can also do it if you're leaving the house outside as well. So five things that you can see. So just look around the room. So I can see my dog, I can see a painting, the door handle, the television, and a mug, let's say. So five things that you can see. Then four things that you can hear. So this could be, for example, right now I can hear the wind howling outside. I can hear the dog breathing. I can hear, you know, that kind of buzz of static electricity. And maybe I can hear some music that's on the radio or something like that. So five things you can see, four things you can hear. Then you want to go to three things that you can touch. So this could be my phone, my water bottle, and piece of paper that I've got here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got two things that you can smell. So there's not much in this room. Lip balm, maybe, and like shampoo.
Okay.
So you'll be able to get something. And the last thing is one thing that you can taste. So that will usually be the last thing you ate, coffee or, you know, sandwich or whatever it might be, or your toothpaste. So what that's doing is it's giving you something to focus on. So you aren't thinking, oh my gosh, how's this going to go? I'm really stressed and worried. Is my dog going to do okay at this? So it's giving you that focus. It's also using a different part of your brain. You're tapping into your senses. So you don't have the anxiety running so much because you are busy grounding yourself, essentially. So you're grounding yourself by using your senses to experience the world around you. So that's something I used to do with my dogs, or before I left my dog. in the living room. And then when I went outside, if I started to feel really anxious and jittery, I could do it outside as well. So, and you've got a whole different scene outside, so you can start all over again and find different things. So yeah, that would be my go-to. Another one that you can do, and you don't want this to become a pre-departure cue for your dog. Uh-huh. So I wouldn't use your hand in this example. I would just use your eyes. So you're going to pick something in the room that you're in that is either rectangular or square. So it could be a picture frame, a mirror, a doorway, anything you like, a rug on the floor. And you just want to trace it with your eyes. So I'm going to show you with my finger. So you would just breathe in, go up, breathe out, go across, breathe in, go down, and breathe out and go across that way. But of course, we're not going to use our hands. We're not going to alert our dogs that we're leaving. So up using your eyes, down and across. So it's just pairing your breathing with, again, using your senses is going to calm you down as well.
Oh, great. Yeah. I think last time we talked, you did that square thing, but you were talking about pushing something. I can't remember what it was. Pushing your problems to one side or something.
Yeah, so there's a few ways that you can try it. If you're really, really het up, I would probably just focus on just using your eyes. But if you're a little bit calmer, you can imagine kind of pushing worries to one side as you go sideways, and then breathing in, like feeling something positive, like courage or inspiration or positivity, and then again pushing and then pulling. So yeah, you can add words and thoughts to it if you want to, if you're in a headspace to be able to do that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I remember doing it with you when you were showing me, and I was like, yes, push the problems to one side.
Yeah. I do think that kind of visual, I think it depends what kind of like learner you are or whatever, but I do find visualization really does help me. And also having, like for me, what I'm thinking about is when I'm running and I get to like a really big hill and I'm already tired, like having like a mantra, you know, like, you can do this, you can do this, like yeah. The whole time I'm running up the hill, just to kind of, I think it's for me, it seems a little bit similar to that grounding exercise, the 5-4-3-2-1, like just focusing on, you know, something different than the pain my body might be feeling, like the my muscle fatigue or how it's getting harder to breathe or like whatever, mm-hmm. but just like focusing on either like visualizing a spot at the top, which sometimes that can be a little demoralizing, but you know, just like little tricks like that, and I do think you know, play with some of these strategies like the 5-4-3-2-1 or the rectangle breathing one and see what works for you, because I do think for different people, different things might work better or worse.
Yeah, definitely. We're all slightly different in terms of what works. The most common kind of advice that's given out for anxiety or feeling worried about things is breathing, sort of doing breathing techniques. I don't think they work for everybody.
I'm not a breather. I find myself holding my breath a lot, like just in day-to-day living. And when I try to focus on it, I actually feel really uncomfortable and like too conscious of it, and then it makes it makes me breathe worse.
It's like when you suddenly notice you're blinking and then you're like, I can't stop blinking.
I wish you hadn't mentioned that.
Yeah, when you draw attention to it sometimes it can make it harder, but like you say, some people really love breathing exercises, so yeah, it's good to have a few things in your toolkit, so depending on either what kind of person you are, how you are that day, you can pick and choose what works for you.
I have had clients you know, if they're feeling a bit anxious, just it's kind of a yoga thing, but you know, just flop over. So the blood is, I guess, rushing to their head and just like all loosey, nice and loose. And they're just literally bending from the waist and flopping over and just relaxing there, maybe swinging their arms a little bit. I find that for me helps a lot. So before they walk out the door, again, that could become a pre-departure cue, but yeah.
Yeah, but if you're using it for only safe absences, it's just a cue to a safe absence, and that's okay.
There's lots and lots of things that you can do in the moment. I think as well, you want to think about preparing for potentially feeling anxious. So almost like the work you're doing with your dog, you want to make it a safe absence for you as well.
Right.
So one of the best ways of doing that, and this is actually quite helpful because as we know, as humans, we sometimes have a tendency to push. So I'm just going to try one more repetition with my dog. I'm just going to do one more and see what happens. And often when we do that push, when we think we probably shouldn't, that's when it does go a little bit wrong sometimes, and then we feel very bad. So
right.
In order for it to be effective for our dog, it also has to be effective for you as well. So thinking about, actually, if I do push and do that extra repetition that I know I probably shouldn't do, how am I going to feel afterwards? And asking yourself those questions before you start, that will help to keep you within the guidelines and keep you on track a little bit. Yeah.
That's a really good one. I hadn't thought about like kind of framing it in that way, but I do think it's really true, especially like I'll have, clients with like a more active scenario and a more like chill scenario. Like they've had a day with a lot of enrichment and exercise and they're really tired now. And they really know that their dog is in the more active camp at that point. So they should be doing a shorter duration because it's a little bit more difficult for their dog, but they'll push to the more active one or the more settled duration just because it feels better to do, you know, a 30-minute exercise than an 8-minute exercise. But then you're putting the dog into the position where they might not succeed. And so it's kind of that, I think that's a really nice way of helping people think all the way through to the other side, to looking at the consequences before you're actually making that decision.
Yeah, definitely. And thinking as well about, of course, we're working with emotion here, but we also can think about it in terms of building a skill. So the skill that the dog is learning is to feel safe on their own. And so I like to try and encourage people to remember, when was something that you learned for the very first time that was really hard going? So maybe it was learning a language at school, maybe it was learning an instrument, maybe it was learning a new process at work, learning to drive, whatever it was that didn't come naturally to you, and you think about it, thought, god, that took me months or that took me years to achieve that skill. And remembering that and even writing that on a post-it note and sticking it wherever you make your separation anxiety notes, or sticking it on your front door. So when you go to do that departure, you remember, actually, yeah, I'm not going to push it because my dog is learning a skill for the first time or the 10th time and they don't have it yet. So that can be helpful as well when we forget about the emotion and we think, oh, I'm just going to try and push it just a little bit.
Yeah. And that can be really hard not to want to push it, especially if you have deadlines. I'm going back to work in 3 months, or I'm, you know, fill in the blank, whatever your deadline is, it can be really hard not to let that pressure kind of creep into the decisions you're making, about how you're training your dog.
Yeah. And that's kind of reflective to how we parent humans as well, isn't it? Thinking about all the pressures that are put on parents of human children. And so we think, oh gosh, I've only got a certain amount of time. We better rush this. And then it all goes a bit wrong. There's a meltdown, the child screaming and shouting. And we're thinking, what did I do? If only I could rewind 30 minutes. And it, yeah, kind of parallels how we are with our dogs sometimes, for sure.
Yeah. That's a really good analogy. And I'm kind of thinking about like potty training. All the pressure that we put on kids when we're trying to potty train them, particularly, like, I don't know if it's this way for y'all, but like a lot of times the preschools, like the 3-year-old preschool classes, like the kids have to be potty trained before they can go to 3-year-old preschool. And so for a lot of parents, you know, they're really looking forward to that 3 hours off or whatever. And so it can feel like it's really important to get this done, you know, and sometimes they'll pressure kids. And then it ends up making it a bigger issue than if they had just been like, okay, it'll happen when it happens kind of thing. But that's, I think, one of those that's a very common thing that we as parents kind of put pressure on our kids about.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Something else that I like to do with my clients is having a joy jar. So it's a glass jar full of things that you and your dog love to do together that are nothing to do with separation anxiety training. And it can be used in two ways. So it can be used as a celebration. Wow, you just did 15 minutes. That was incredible. Let's pick something fun from your jar and we'll do it together. Or it can be, oh, buddy, that went a bit wrong. I'm sorry. Let's take something from your jar and do it together. So it's kind of both sides of the step.
I thought you were going to say,
yeah,
you did it wrong. No jar for you.
I also like that, Holly, as a way to remember all of the ways that you love your dog or all of the fun things that you do together, right? Because when your dog has a behavioral problem like separation anxiety, and some of these dogs have other struggles as well. And so it's like, you know, it can feel like your whole relationship with your dog is about their behavioral struggle instead of the things that you like doing together or the cute way they sleep or, you know.
You mean like my dog behind me?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So I think, you know, I like the jar because it not only gives you like a fun way to celebrate or like a good way to take the sting out of bad sessions, but also a way of remembering how cool your dog is and how, you know, the relationship that you have together and how, and all the ways you can celebrate that.
Yeah, for sure.
One of my clients used to put she had a sticky note on the door that she would leave from, and it was like the top five things that she loved about her dog because her dog was very variable in the home alone training. And so that was like a way we did do breathing exercises before she left, but that was another thing that she did, like as a way, like when she walked out the door, she would just, you know, see that and just remember, I love my dog. I love my dog. I love my dog. So.
Yeah,
I guess definitely. One other aspect of this training is the dog guardian has to be disciplined in many senses. So if they want it to work, they need some element of consistency, you know, in the training. I guess my question is, do you have any tips for people to, you know, maybe because I don't know, Stacey does running, so she's nice and fit and active. But I mean, I guess there's times when she should go out for a run, maybe, and she doesn't feel like going out.
When it's cold, I have so much trouble getting my butt outside when it's cold because, like, I just really don't like running in the cold. I mean, a little bit cold is okay, but like when it's like freezing cold, I'm just like, ah. Yeah.
So what would you say to Stacey and, you know, people with separation anxiety dogs when they're just like, I really don't want to do it? How are we going to discipline Stacey?
You got to get me in line, Holly. You got to do it.
It's a really tough one because I often, I'm a bit like, ooh, when should you push yourself and when should you look after yourself? And that's a fine line to walk sometimes. I think you want to build self-care slots into your week. And self-care is a bit of a buzzword now. It's got a bit like, oh, just have a bubble bath and go for a walk and everything will be okay.
That's good.
Not the case. But you want to think specifically about what works for you. And that could be a glass of wine with a friend. That could be sitting and watching reruns of the latest thing on Netflix. It could be whatever it is. It doesn't matter. There's no judgment in terms of what it is, as long as it's not too naughty. But you want to build those into your week so you know you've got them coming. So what I say to people is, let's say you've got a calendar Monday to Sunday, build in at least three sessions. So say Monday, Friday, Sunday, where you know you've got a good couple of hours to do something you enjoy. Now, it could be something in the house if you can't currently leave the house, or if you have got someone that can stay with the dog, then it might be out somewhere else. So you've got those coming. So it's almost like a reward. So if I can do my three slots of training on Monday, then I can have that nice thing Monday evening, for example. And then I tend to give people two emergency passes as well. So if you're just having a terrible day and you're just like, I am so demotivated today, I can't even do my job, let alone any separation anxiety training. Okay, I'm going to use one of my emergency passes today. And you've got two of those per week as well. So it's kind of like you've got a bit of some leeway to play with. Mm-hmm. That way you won't just not do the work and then beat yourself up, kind of like we were saying right at the beginning, and then just get stuck in that pattern of not doing it and feeling worse and worse. But it also means that you can push yourself in those times where you've used all your passes, or you know you've got something nice to look forward to in the rest of the week. So yeah, that's how mm-hmm. I would tackle it, I think.
Yeah. I think for me, not that this is about me, but it's coming around. It's going to come around. For me, one of the things with my running is like, I wake up, Rowan doesn't like to run, so I don't take him with me. So I take him for a walk and I eat and I check like emails and client plans and all of that kind of stuff. And then I go for my run. Well, this time of year, it's too cold when I would usually run. So that slot in my routine where it usually happens, it can't happen anymore. So then in the afternoon, when it really is the warmest time of day, I'm already like, that's my low energy part of the day. So then it's harder for me to do. So I guess what I'm trying to say is like, for some people, tying it to another part of your routine can be a really helpful way of making sure that it happens. Or I think for me, that's really helpful because I am more of a routine person. Again, it's not going to be helpful for everybody, but for some people, and then, but then it has that backlash of like, if it needs to change, it's like, oh no, oh no.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because some people, like you say, some people love routine. Some people mm-hmm. are just completely scattered and work so right. much better in that way. And then it can be hard if you're that second type of person to say, oh, I'm going to commit to X amount of sessions per week, because it's like, oh, right. I don't even know what I'm doing on a Monday.
Because it can feel smothering, right? Like if you're yeah. not. And for some of my clients, they, you know, like I'll suggest, okay, try to train 5 or 6 days a week, and this is what it's going to look like. And they're like, can I train 7 days? Because if I miss one day, then I'm never going to, like, I'll fall off. And so it's really interesting how for some people, thinking about training 5 days a week is really smothering. But for other people, thinking about skipping some days is like, then my whole plan is going to be derailed. So I think part of it, as like part of our job as working with pet parents, is figuring out how to help them be successful, right? Like, yeah. I think, you know, it's really nice to know all these different types of strategies, because then in talking with your clients, you can be like, okay, it sounds like this is going to be a really good strategy for you. But for you, we have to do something different, because that's not going to meld with your personality or how you cope and deal and think about things.
Yeah, for sure. And I would say that if you are listening and you are a pet parent, dog guardian, whatever you want to call yourself, don't be afraid to be honest with the person that you're working with about how you're really feeling, because honestly, we've heard it all. Like there's nothing that can shock us. Like even if you're having the most awful feelings about your dog currently, like it's okay. So, yeah.
And honestly, we can't really help you through what you're struggling with if you don't tell us how you're feeling. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really, cause I've had clients who I've been on a lighter touch package with, so I wasn't meeting with them every week or even every other week. And then all of a sudden they'll say, you know, I feel like I want to rehome my dog. Like and I had no idea. I mean, training seemed to be going well, and like, you know, like everything from where I was sitting seemed to be going well, but the way they were feeling didn't reflect that. And so like, we had this whole conversation, we tweaked our strategy to make it feel better to the client. And then it was fine, but it was just one of those things where I'm like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. How did I miss that? Of course, I beat myself up about that.
Of course.
But that can be so helpful for us to know, where is your head at? What about the training are you finding difficult, or even, you know, what are you dreading it? Are you feeling resentful of your dog? Are you like, we need to know that stuff so we can help you navigate that.
Yeah, for sure. And for them to also acknowledge that there will be ups and downs, I think is important as well. Yeah. And if they know that, then maybe they can cope a bit better, maybe.
I do wish I had a magic wand, for the record.
Yeah.
I would share it with y'all.
Y'all.
Definitely. Y'all. The other thing that's a bit of a phenomenon in human psychology is that often we want to give up, even when to the outsider, it looks like we're doing the best we've ever done. And we're thinking, what's going on? Why is this person suddenly really super despondent when they've just been making all this amazing progress? And it's because when we first start seeing progress and results, it's really motivating. It's like, oh yeah, this is working. It's doing really well. And then you might have a couple of setbacks and then you get back on track and it's doing really well. But then the person suddenly looks at the spreadsheet or however they're recording their training and they're like, yeah, but oh my gosh, that's been weeks or months and we're only at 50 minutes or we're only at 20 minutes. And us as the professionals, we're like, you've done amazingly. You've got from zero all the way up to 45 minutes. But that person's like, this feels still so far away from me being able to go out for dinner with my family or being able to go and watch a film for 2.5 hours without watching my phone the entire time, wondering if my dog's okay. And so that's why people can then start to drop off even when they're like excelling.
Right.
So it's having those kind of almost preparing people for that and saying, you're going to feel like this at some point. It's normal. It's natural. Just tell me. Please just tell me when it happens.
Yeah. Isn't that called something? I just seem to remember seeing like a graph of that thought, that kind of progression that people make was when they first commit to working through something that, you know, that even if they're not very successful, they're excited about starting taking steps to resolution. And then exactly what you're saying, Holly, is that they, even if they're still progressing, it just feels like they've lost steam or something.
It's probably the something effect, I expect.
Yes, the something effect.
It's very technical, very scientific.
I think it must be great, Holly, you know, because you have got that psychology background to, you know, you're understanding what people are going through, and, you know, you can support them through that really nicely. And plus you've been there as well.
Yeah, and I think that always helps, doesn't it? It's interesting. I'm sure you'll have had this experience if you guys have had dogs with separation anxiety yourselves. But when you tell that to someone and you almost see their shoulders drop, this sigh of relief, like, oh, you get it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because it's kind of like if you go to the doctor and you say, oh, I've got these symptoms, and they give you a diagnosis, and you kind of often come away feeling like, oh, I got given a load of information, but I don't feel they really understood what it was like for me. Whereas then you can have that kind of relation where you say, oh my gosh, yes, honestly, I've been there and it's awful, I get it. That can be quite helpful for people, I think.
Yeah and giving them hope as well.
Holly, let's tell people where they can find you on social media, the name of your podcast, all of that stuff, in case they want to get in touch with you.
Yeah, sure. So my podcast for dog guardians is called Letters from Your Dog. And the podcast for pet professionals is Training Dogs, Training People, and Keeping Our Beep Together. Just blacking that out for you. And then you can find me on Instagram at Paws Up Dogs Training and Facebook, just Paws Up Dogs. So we're on all the main places as well.
Fabulous. Yeah. Fabulous.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I hope it's such an important conversation to have. People are going through it. They need to know this stuff. I think it's really important. Yeah. So thank you.
I think it's that whole put your own oxygen mask on first kind of thing, you know, making sure that you're taking care of yourself is a really important thing.
Yeah.
So very good. So everybody check out Dr. Holly Tett. She's got some awesome stuff going on her website and stuff. So
yeah.
Yes, do it.
Thank you.
Do it. All right.
Thank you for listening to Tales from the Doghouse, Separation Anxiety Explained. I am Ness Jones in Australia from Separation Anxiety in Dogs Decoded.
And I am Stacey Bell with Focused Fun in the US.
Cool. So make sure you like and subscribe. Like the podcast, subscribe to the YouTube channel, etc., etc.
Fabulous. Thanks for joining us today.
See ya.
Bye. Thank you.